And Maya Stone. Today we have a very special program. We're going to discuss truth as casualty. And this is a reflection on the rewriting of the 60s, the 1960s, the fervent 60s. And after our brief discussion, we're opening the lines for your input, for your questions and your comments. And the number to call will be 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. Ralph, what was the impetus for this program?
The impetus, Maya, is an article that appeared in Truthdig and then repeated or carried on Portside and distributed rather widely. An article by Carol Brightman, who in the 1960s was the editor of something called Viet Report, reviewing a series of books and memoirs about the 1960s and the struggle against war and imperialism of that time. The article in question attempts to reprise the events in which I happen to be involved quite directly, namely those of the International War Crimes Tribunal and of my work with Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre. The article that purports to be a synopsis of the history of struggle in that time is so false in its representations and contains such extraordinary inventions of the events involved that I felt compelled to respond. And the response, in a certain way, illuminates what the issues were. I think our readers, our audience, I should say, our brothers and sisters who hear Taking Aim, should perhaps have an opportunity to hear a response to this widely distributed piece.
Later today, Ralph's written article, Truth is Casualty, a response to Carol Brightman and Carl Oglesby on the 60s, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, along with the archive of today's program. So look later at www.takingaimradio.com. Ralph?
Truth is Casualty. A response to Carol Brightman and Carl Oglesby on the 60s. In an article entitled Carol Brightman on the 60s in Truthdig on January 3, 2008, Ms. Brightman reviews three books, including Ravens in the Storm, A Personal History of the 1960s Anti-War Movement by Carl Oglesby. The article is replete with falsehoods and disinformation concerning the work of the International Tribunal on U.S. War Crimes in Indochina, of which I was Secretary General, and of my role within it. Ms. Brightman's errors, large and small, embellished the pattern of distortion in Mr. Oglesby's book. The most egregious of these fabrications concerns the views of Jean-Paul Sartre, Executive President of the Tribunal, and of other tribunal members on the question of genocide. Ms. Brightman's claims regarding her own role are instructive, not merely for their petty misrepresentations, but for what she conceals. She writes, quote, "Early in 1967, I had gone on the second of the tribunal's two fact-finding teams to North Vietnam, the only American and only woman," unquote. In fact, not two, but six investigative teams were sent to Cambodia and North Vietnam, with supplemental investigative work carried out in the liberated zones of South Vietnam. Ms. Brightman was not the sole American on the second team, but one of three. She omits to mention that members of these teams had been briefed about the sensitivity of our work notably in countries under agonizingly massive and continuous attack by overwhelming U.S. air and ground assault. Each potential participant had been vetted for their qualifications to examine evidence pertaining to the issues at hand, and in particular for responsible discretion with respect to U.S. intelligence efforts to obtain information about Vietnamese, Cambodian, and Laotian logistics on the ground. Visas for members of these teams were arranged with the authorities in these countries based upon such assurances. To our dismay, when we boarded the plane in Paris for Phnom Penh, accompanying Miss Brightman was a man unknown to us who carried an ABC television camera. Miss Brightman stated that this was her boyfriend, whom she had invited to join our investigative team and participate in its work. We explained that this was not possible, that he was unknown to us, had not been placed on the team, and had not been approved for visas by the governments of Cambodia and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. We advised her that he would not be admitted to Phnom Penh unless he had a visa arranged by ABC, and that, regardless, he would have no part in our work. On arrival, he gained entry by representing falsely that he was a late inclusion in our investigative team. He shared quarters with Miss Brightman, who attempted daily to insinuate him in our work. This was refused by the team collectively. Members of the investigative team met to decide how to deal with this situation. The abiding sentiment was to remove Miss Brightman from the team and exclude her from its work. There were concerns that we were in the presence of a provocation intended to discredit the team itself. It was agreed that I would consult the Cambodian and Vietnamese authorities and describe the situation fully. We learned that Miss Brightman's friend had attempted to interview officials and individuals presenting himself as Bertrand Russell's representative. He was asked by the Cambodian authorities to leave. He showed up in Saigon, where he conducted interviews with U.S. soldiers, later shown on U.S. television. These were interviews sympathetic to U.S. policy. The Vietnamese representatives in Phnom Penh alerted Hanoi to the situation, and it was agreed that to avoid a public dispute deployed by U.S. media to undermine the work of the tribunal, Miss Brightman would continue with us to Hanoi, but that she would not be allowed access to any sensitive zone or area. In her article, Miss Brightman describes, quote, drinking and swapping stories, unquote, at the Metropole Hotel in Hanoi. Quote, Chuan Minh, it was said, had stood up at a dinner with North Vietnamese leaders and rebuked them for thinking of peace. He raised his glass in a victory salute. No one responded, unquote. The story is risible. I had been meeting with Ho Chi Minh, Pham Van Dong, and party and governmental figures over a period of 4 years to discuss how most effectively to wage resistance to the U.S. war internationally, including our preparations for the tribunal that had been ongoing since 1963. I was chair at the time of the Vietnamese Solidarity Campaign in Great Britain with 60 member organizations. Our public view, and that of Bertrand Russell during those years, was that we must face U.S. rulers with the demand out now, not pressure the Vietnamese victims of onslaught to make concessions to U.S. imperial policy in the name of, quote, peace, unquote. The occasion of these remarks was Miss Brightman, the occasion of these remarks by Miss Brightman is an ostensible review of our Carl Oglesby's memoir. Miss Brightman quotes extensively from, quote, Oglesby's account, unquote, which she states, quote, gives a vivid portrait of Ralph Chuan Minh, the American expatriate and Russell's representative, unquote. Mr. Oglesby writes as follows, quote, Chuan Minh was about 30, a tall man with broad shoulders. He wore his black hair combed straight back and varnished down. His skin was pale, his dark eyes nervous and darkly shadowed. He was always in a black turtleneck sweater and dark blue blazer, always stiffly erect with his chest out, unquote. Mr. Oglesby's self-description to the tribunal was as a, quote, playwright and political essayist, unquote. And perhaps he thinks of himself as entitled to dramatic license. My height is under 5 feet, 10 inches, and I am of slender build. My shoulders are not broad, nor does my chest protrude. My weight was in the 150s in 1967. It is 145 today. My hair is not black, but medium brown. I have never combed it straight back nor plastered it to my scalp. My hair was combed loosely forward, Beatles style. My color, now as then, is pretty good. I've never been accused of suffering from pallor. My eyes are light hazel with a touch of green, not black or even dark. I have never owned a black turtleneck sweater nor attempted to wear one. My standard dress was a suit or a jacket, dress shirt, and necktie. My preference in pullovers, worn occasionally in less formal settings, has been those of light colors. Mr. Oglesby may have someone else in mind. He writes, however, to Miss Brightman's delectation, and I quote, quote, in a closed meeting of the tribunal during our second session in late November, in a town called Roskilde, about 20 miles from Copenhagen, Schoenman announced that Russell wanted the tribunal to take an affirmative position on the genocide question, one of several questions the tribunal was examining. Quote, the practical question was the United States was specifically targeting Vietnamese population centers. Attacks on civilians constituted a crime of war, technical genocide. Schoenman told us that Russell believed such attacks were happening and that the United States was therefore guilty of genocide. Oglesby continues, quote, Sartre disagreed. He saw American attacks on population centers as a consequence of the fact that Viet Cong and North Vietnamese combat units often stationed themselves in cities and villages. As Sartre saw it, such attacks were deplorable, but nonetheless did not constitute genocide. In Sartre's view, one could not use that term without evoking memories of Hitler's assault upon the Jews. Compared to the Holocaust, what the United States was doing in Vietnam was just fighting an ugly war in an ugly way. If the United States was in the wrong, he felt, that was because its effort to subdue the Vietnamese resistance was in itself wrong, not because the United States was trying to exterminate the Vietnamese people, unquote. The claim by Mr. Oglesby that U.S. saturation destruction of the civilian population of Vietnam only occurred as an ancillary consequence of the deliberate placement by the Vietnamese of their soldiers and armed forces inside population centers is not merely a deeply reactionary and dishonest claim. It was the lying rationale of the U.S. State Department and of the Pentagon. Miss Brightman writes, quote, Oglesby was a great admirer of Jean-Paul Sartre, who, together with Simone de Beauvoir and Vlado Dedier, a World War II adjutant of Tito's and a hero of the Yugoslav anti-Nazi resistance, presided over the tribunal. Schoenman represented Lord Russell, who remained a ghostly figure in Wales, unquote. Fathering this contemptible lie upon Jean-Paul Sartre is a strange form of admiration. Mr. Oglesby, cheered on by Miss Brightman in her review, imputes to Sartre a defense of U.S. imperialism against the baseless charge of genocide, quote-unquote. He places in Sartre's mouth the revolting rationale of U.S. rulers themselves, that the mass death of civilians in Vietnam was really the fault of the callous Vietnamese communists who hid their armies within population centers to deploy massive civilian deaths, now called collateral damage, as cynical propaganda. Mr. Oglesby elaborates upon these presumptive views of Sartre, which he claims Sartre set forth in indignant opposition to my assertions that genocidal attacks on the Vietnamese population were taking place. Quote, All day long, Schoenman would say, on the one hand, things like, Lord Russell says he expects the tribunal to find the United States guilty of genocide, where the subtext was that Russell was paying for the damn thing and did not want to be unhappy with its findings. And then, on the other hand, when Sartre challenged him on the genocide issue, Schoenman would say, don't expect me to defend Lord Russell's positions because I would not think of speaking for him, unquote. This is bizarre. I had been speaking and writing for 6 years on the subject. The Student Peace Union in the United States had published Bertrand Russell's writing on the genocidal war in Vietnam in 1963. Bertrand Russell's book, War Crimes in Vietnam, written before the tribunal took place, set forth evidence we had made public since 1962. The first chapter, entitled, quote, The Press and Vietnam, March to July 1963, unquote, contains our exchanges with the New York Times regarding our documented evidence of U.S. saturation bombing of the civilian populace and of insidious chemical weapons, including gases that explode the pupil of the eye. It cites our letter to the New York Times referencing, quote, a year's study of the chemicals sprayed in South Vietnam and their effect upon the health of human beings, animals, and crops, unquote. It sets forth data concerning the use of, quote, white arsenic, various kinds of arsenite sodium and arsenite calcium, lead manganese arsenates, DNP and DNC, which inflame and eat into human flesh, and calcic cyanamide, which has seriously affected thousands of the inhabitants of South Vietnam. With having spread these poisonous chemicals on large and densely populated areas of South Vietnam, the use of these weapons, we stated, napalm bombs and chemicals, constitutes and results in atrocities and points to the fact that this is a war of annihilation, unquote. This chapter describes how the New York Times published this letter while excising the cited evidence and then accused Russell in an editorial of, quote, spreading communist propaganda, as he in his heart must know, unquote. It is instructive to note that Mr. Oglesby imputes to Jean-Paul Sartre the view that Bertrand Russell and I were, quote, following the line of North Vietnam, unquote, on the subject of genocide. War Crimes in Vietnam was published in 1967 by Monthly Review Press and by George Allen and Unwin Limited. It included a 48-page essay of mine containing a detailed eyewitness account of the weaponry used and the effects on the population of North Vietnam. It lists the members of the tribunal. Mr. Oglesby was not among them. It describes the planned convening of the tribunal in London on November 13, 1966, quote, to announce its structure, statement of aims, and timetable, unquote. It specified 5 areas of inquiry for which evidence would be assembled. The 5th was, quote, the pursuit of genocidal policies, including forced labor camps, mass burials, and other techniques of extermination in the South, unquote. This issue and the evidence pertaining to it was on the agenda in Roskilde, near Copenhagen. As I described in our work, in Against the Crime of Silence, quote, we proclaimed our conviction that terrible crimes were occurring, that we were in possession of evidence of such magnitude that it was essential to investigate the charges of this accusation. Our evidence established that 8 million people were placed in barbed wire internment camps by U.S. and South Vietnamese forces. It showed the systematic destruction of hospitals, schools, sanatoria, dams, dikes, churches, and pagodas. It demonstrated that the cultural remains of a rich and complex civilization, representing the legacy of generations, had been smashed in a terror of 5 million pounds of high explosives daily. Every 9 months, this destruction is roughly equivalent to the total bombardment of the Pacific Theater in World War II. It is as if the Louvre and the cathedrals had been doused in napalm and pulverized by 1,000-pound bombs, unquote. Mr. Oglesby does not rest at fathering upon Jean-Paul Sartre a rejection of my presumptive dogmatic insistence, allegedly without concern for evidence, that genocide was occurring in Vietnam. Mr. Oglesby attributes a fundamental division on these matters to the tribunal members at large. Quote, apart from the existential problems between Sartre and Schoenemann, this split over the question of genocide was the one serious split among the members of the tribunal. In crudest terms, Russell wanted a guilty verdict on this question, but Sartre was determined to let the evidence speak for itself. And as Sartre saw it, the evidence did not prove genocide. Sartre thought it essential that the tribunal demonstrate its independence by voting to satisfy its own conscience, and he let it be known that he thought Russell in the wrong to push North Vietnam's line, unquote. Miss Brightman, typically, cannot resist embellishing this citation. The word propaganda, quote-unquote, is not Mr. Oglesby's, but Miss Brightman's, who slips it into her citation of his text, writing, quote, North Vietnam's propaganda line, unquote. Mr. Oglesby resumes his breathless account of a supposed envenomed exchange on the subject between Jean-Paul Sartre and myself. Quote, Schoenemann didn't seem to care terribly about the quality of the evidence. He had already harangued several closed sessions about this and was doing it again, unquote. Miss Brightman picks up the theme eagerly from Mr. Oglesby. Quote, Lord Russell was unhappy to hear of the recent attacks upon him by certain tribunal members, unquote, Schoenemann said. Quote, he is all the more distressed by these attacks in that they are occasioned by large differences within the tribunal on the issue of genocide. No one has attacked Russell, said Dellinger, who acted as the tribunal's secretary and occasional peacemaker. We simply disagree with him on this question. Why does he consider disagreement a personal attack? The quote continues from Brightman and Oglesby. That is for Lord Russell to say, said Schoenemann. I would not presume to speak for him. I am here only to say that Lord Russell believes the United States guilty of genocide in Vietnam and that he will be disappointed if the tribunal continues to attack him for this view. He believes it imperative that, quote, Premier, thundered Sartre, our findings will be significant only if they are supported by facts. Deuxième, it is you who are under attack, Schoenemann, not Lord Russell. Troisième, you cannot both stand behind Lord Russell and put him in your pocket, unquote. Miss Brightman then writes as follows, quote, Schoenemann bowed his head slightly but kept his composure. Quote, I will see that Lord Russell receives a faithful account of your statement, unquote. Quote, it was not a knockout, as Oglesby puts it, unquote. Revealingly, Miss Brightman tampers with the quotation once again. Mr. Oglesby had written actually, quote, it was not a knockout, unquote, with regard to the putative denunciation of my views by Jean-Paul Sartre. Miss Brightman alters Oglesby's text and places his, quote, knockout, unquote, comment after my presumptive rejoinder. Mr. Oglesby's breathless blow-by-blow dramatization of this imputed conflict between Jean-Paul Sartre and myself, unfolding as he recounts it in Roskilde, near Copenhagen, during the second session of the International War Crimes Tribunal, has one fatal flaw to which readers should be alerted. I was never there. The entire drama in Roskilde, set forth by Mr. Oglesby, never happened. Nor was my inability to enter Denmark for the session of the tribunal that Mr. Oglesby purports to describe something known only to insiders. After my imprisonment in Bolivia, immediately after the execution of Che Guevara, during October 1967, a and following upon a five-month sojourn in Yanqawazoo during the time of Che's Bolivia campaign, I had escaped, was recaptured, and imprisoned again. After being deported to Peru, Panama, and the U.S., my passport was nullified. The State Department refused to issue another despite legal intervention by Leonard Boudin, General Counsel of the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee. I secured an international travel document from the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. In a vain attempt to get to Copenhagen and Roskilde to resume my duties as Secretary General of the Tribunal and to be present at the session, my flight first landed in Amsterdam, where I was taken into custody by airport police. My Swedish lawyer, Hans-Göran Frank, who was an active part of the preparatory team of the tribunal in Stockholm, arranged with the Swedish government to allow my entry into Stockholm, whose good offices, it was assumed, would be invoked to facilitate my admission into Denmark, albeit on a North Vietnamese travel document. Instead, the Swedish police took me off the flight and into jail, where I was roughed up, my sternum fractured. I was then placed on a plane bound for Hamburg. Swedish supporters called in a bomb threat to the plane, and it was compelled to return to Stockholm to much fanfare in the European press. From there, I was placed on a flight that stopped in Helsinki, where the police took me into custody. The name of the interrogating officer was Kafka, a touch one would think that would suit the theater of the absurd that so tempts Mr. Oglesby. For several days, I was a flying Dutchman, unable to land in any European country, placed finally on a flight back to New York, sandwiched between two U.S. federal agents. All of this received ongoing notice in the media, particularly in Sweden and Denmark. I was not permitted to enter Denmark and did not attend the Danish session of the tribunal, nor engage in dialogue with any of its members. Mr. Oglesby is not fazed. Describing further his, quote, adventures, unquote, in Copenhagen, he writes, quote, also sitting on the tribunal was the Polish historian Isaac Deutscher, author of major biographies of Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin, unquote. Unfortunately, my close friend Isaac died of a heart attack in Rome the previous August 18th, and like me, was absent from the tribunal session in Roskilde. The second session of the tribunal alone examined the sixth question on which evidence was presented during that meeting, namely, quote, whether the combination of the crimes imputed to the government of the United States met the general qualification of genocide, unquote. This issue was discussed in Copenhagen, but without me. What then of the actual opinions of Jean-Paul Sartre on the subject of genocide and on the judgment appropriate to the tribunal? Did he espouse the views ascribed to him by Mr. Oglesby? Fortunately, although Sartre is no longer with us, his views on the subject are memorialized in his presentation on genocide, published in Against the Crime of Silence, Proceedings of the Russell International War Crimes Tribunal, Stockholm and Copenhagen, O'Hare Books, 1968, pages 612 to 626, and expanded upon by tribunal member Lelio Basso in his Summation on Genocide, pages 626 to 643. These views are entirely consonant with those of Russell and myself. Sartre's On Genocide states, quote, the Americans want to show others that guerrilla war does not pay. They want to show all the oppressed and the exploited nations that might be tempted to shake off the American yoke by launching a people's war, at first against their own pseudo-governments, the compradors and the army, and then against the United States Special Forces, and finally against the GIs. To Che Guevara, who said, quote, we need several Vietnams, unquote, the American government answers, they will all be crushed the way we are crushing the first, unquote. Sartre continues, quote, they do offer an alternative. declare you are beaten or we will bomb you back into the Stone Age. The fact remains that the second term of this alternative is genocide. They have said, quote, genocide, yes, but conditional genocide, unquote. Is this juridically valid? He writes, is it even conceivable? Quote, Sartre continues, an act of genocide, especially if it is carried out over a period of several years, is no less genocide for being blackmail. And this is all the more true when, as is the case here, a good part of the group has been annihilated to force the rest to give in, unquote. Jean-Paul Sartre is clear, specific, and passionate. Quote, in the South, the choice is the following. Villages burned, the populace subjected to massive bombing, livestock shot, vegetation destroyed by defoliants, crops ruined by toxic aerosols, and everywhere indiscriminate shooting, murder, rape, and looting. This is genocide in the strictest sense, massive extermination. What are the Vietnamese people to do to escape this horrible death? Join the armed forces of Saigon, or be enclosed in strategic or new life hamlets, two names for the same concentration camps, unquote. Jean-Paul Sartre continues, quote, as the armed forces of the United States entrench themselves firmly in Vietnam, as they intensify the bombing and the massacres, as they try to bring Laos under their control, as they plan the invasion of Cambodia, there is less and less doubt that the government of the United States, despite its hypocritical denials, has chosen genocide, unquote. Despite the claims by Ms. Brightman, Pache, Mr. Oglesby, that Sartre rejected the evidence of genocide marshaled at the International Tribunal on United States War Crimes in Indochina, his actual words demonstrate where their half-truths lie. Jean-Paul Sartre was unambiguous, quote, the genocidal intent is implicit in the facts. It is necessarily premeditated. The anti-guerrilla genocide that our times have produced requires organization, military bases, a structure of accomplices, and budget appropriations. Therefore, its authors must meditate and plan out their act, unquote. Sartre continues as follows, quote, when a peasant falls in his rice paddy, mowed down by a machine gun, every one of us is hit. The Vietnamese fight for all men, and the American forces against all, neither figuratively nor abstractly. And not only because genocide would be a crime universally condemned by international law, but because little by little the whole human race is being subjected to this genocidal blackmail piled on top of atomic blackmail, that is, to absolute total war. This crime carried out every day before the eyes of the world renders all who do not denounce it accomplices of those who commit it, so that we are degraded today for our future enslavement, unquote. Here's how Jean-Paul Sartre concludes his exposition on genocide, quote, in this sense, imperialist genocide can only become more complete. The group that the United States wants to intimidate and terrorize by way of the Vietnamese nation is the human group in its entirety, unquote. Mr. Oglesby and Ms. Brightman have imputed Jean-Paul Sartre, an embrace of the rationale of U.S. rulers for their genocidal war. In the process, they reinvent me as a cat's paw in furthering this farrago. Late in 1968, well after the conclusion of the tribunal sessions, the Stalinist regime of Leonid Brezhnev invaded Czechoslovakia to crush the students and steelworkers fought to reclaim the socialist ideal during the Prague Spring. I flew to Rome to meet Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir at the Hotel Nazionale. We prepared a petition together to summon people to a defense of socialism with democratic control and content. Together, with Bertrand Russell, Antonin Leem, C.L.R. James, and prominent others, we prepared an international conference of socialists and anti-imperialists to defend the Czech worker and student resistance. That conference also took place in Stockholm in early spring 1969. It is not the evil that is new, nor is it the crisis that has changed. Today, 41 years later, Miss Brightman and Mr. Oglesby reprise their political role in these matters. In making truth a casualty to their predilections and petty ambition, they evince now as then the dishonest lengths to which they are prepared to go, and in the process, the limits of liberalism.
You are listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Our program today, this is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and our program, the title is Truth as Casualty. You've been listening to Ralph read from his response to Carol Brightman and Carl Oglesby on the 60s. It'll be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, along with the archive of today's program. We would like to hear from you, and we're opening the lines, 212-209-2900. And our engineer sitting in for Michael G. Haskins today will take your call.
Sean, would you take calls from our listeners?
Okay, we're ready for the first. You're on
Hi.
The air.
Hi. Yeah, I saw your article on John Simpkin's education, JFK Assassination Education Forum website. It's interesting. I'm just wondering, you preface it with the remark that this show would be about the overall media coverage and presentation of the 1960s. And I'm just wondering how you fit this particular article into that wider context. And secondly, in terms of the wider question, I'm very interested in the question of the presentation of the three, well, some would argue four major political assassinations of the 1960s and its disassociation from a rightward movement on the part of both political parties since that time. And by disassociation, what I mean by that is the way that these assassinations are presented as, you know, of course, conspiracy theory, but really the implications and the ideological tendrils of these assassinations, and in particular, their links to what were going on in terms of the social movements that really they partially spoke for example, 1968. The way that these are removed from discussion of the assassinations, and so that they are not linked to an overall movement of history. It's almost though they're put in separate petri dishes and said, and by calling them conspiracy theory, this is a way of saying, well, everything else is history except for this. And I'm just wondering if of your general reaction to how the U.S. bourgeois media has, you know, portrayed the assassinations in this way, or do you see it differently?
No, these are thoughtful and good questions. Let me respond first to the general issue about the use of the 60s by the media. The actual question of how genocide unfolded in Indochina, the nature of the weaponry, the exterminating modality of U.S. war, of course, was something about which media were in total denial. And one of the issues, of course, for all of us at the time was the deep abiding resistance within the opposition to the war itself, to this evidence and to the conclusions that flow from it. And I say that because the outstanding question, as you indicate, is the systemic nature of imperial war of this kind. and it's hardly that Vietnam was something sui generis or came new. So media, for the most part, concealed and covered up the crimes, although what distinguished the period of the 60s from what we experience today is that the media did send back the images of annihilation, the images of people affected by napalm, the images of the impact of white phosphorus, which is an insidious chemical that eats through the through flesh and which cannot be ameliorated or extinguished by water. Water accelerates it until it eats right into bone. These images were flooding the media, the television screens, the newspapers, and even the newsreel reports in movie theaters, so that the public was enormously impacted by the meaning of U.S. imperial genocidal war as it affected the peoples of Indochina and as it affects the peoples of the world. But I want to emphasize that the question of the response of people within the anti-war movement or the resistance in the 60s bore all of the limitations that we see today, namely that there were illusions about the Democratic Party. There were expectations from such politicians. And in that regard, part of the enormous impact of the execution of John F. Kennedy was its disillusioning of vast numbers of people who had such expectations from the Kennedy brothers. Illusional expectations, needless to say, because the Kennedy brothers were fixated on precisely the kinds of counterinsurgency methods of U.S. imperialism that we see at work in Indochina and universally. The use of special forces, the use of assassination squads, Green Berets, Rangers, and later the Phoenix programs that emerged from these, and the obsession that the Kennedy brothers had with James Bond and so on. But on the issue specific to the assassinations that you raise, of course, the fact that Murder Incorporated could define well the ruling class in the United States, the reality that there are differences over the question of how you distribute the spoils and where investment goes are trillion-dollar differences, and they result in murder. That has an enormous educating impact on the people of our country, that the U.S. rulers are Murder, Inc. And consequently, the denial on the part of media and the denial on the part of sections of our movement about the meaning of the assassinations, people like Chomsky, by the way, Noam Chomsky wouldn't come near the Russell Tribunal in all the years that we were assembling evidence pertaining to it. Only after the tribunal's impact had been so universal did Chomsky write a preface for a late publication of the proceedings of that tribunal, but up to then he wouldn't touch it. And that was characteristic of many who had the idea that the war in Vietnam, the war in Indochina, should be mediated, that the Vietnamese should make concessions, that the Vietnamese, they faced the Vietnamese and demanded that the Vietnamese make concessions to the U.S. imperialism in the name of peace, as I mentioned in my article. They did not put their back to the Vietnamese people, face U.S. imperialism, and say, cease the slaughter, out now. The sovereignty, the self-determination of oppressed peoples is our predicate, our work, our obligation. We identify with that. That's who we are. Now, that is a defining difference, and it is the politics then as they are the politics now. One quick further comment, because I do want other callers to phone in. The assassination of the Kennedy brothers is of a very different quality and character than that of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and the countless number of witnesses and opponents of imperialism that have been slaughtered by the U.S. in targeted assassination. The Kennedy brothers are rather like, in my judgment, the question of who killed Caesar. It's sectors of the ruling class, as I say, falling out over the spoils. It's Eastern capital, finance capital, stating, in essence, we don't want major military intervention with its deficit financing, with its arousal of huge movements of opposition, putting to play forces that we cannot contain. We prefer counter-revolution on the cheap, like Green Berets, like assassinations, like coups d'etat, like the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the replacement of Arbenz in Guatemala, like the murder of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo.
You don't buy arguments about the back channel to Cuba. That some, you know, people who argue, look, the CIA was 13 years old. It had been in power and used to doing whatever it wanted under Eisenhower, and there was room for misunderstanding in the Kennedy administration as to who could tell whom what to do. You don't buy that argument.
At the time that the CIA hit teams were organizing the execution of John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, right out of the CIA headquarters, was running an assassination operation using some of these same elements, including Oswald, for plans to assassinate Fidel Castro. The Kennedy brothers had blood on their hands. The Kennedy brothers were fully integrated within this stratagem of targeted execution and of the
no doubt.
Removal
but they
of
also
heads
had
of state.
A back channel, as they had in Laos, going around the, you know, Joint Chiefs of Staff, using the ABC newswoman. And, you know, I don't want to take up your time. It seems to me that there's some room for disagreement there.
Well, let me address this very quickly and very succinctly. The cross-class alliance that the Kennedy brothers implemented in Laos with the three princes, the right-wing prince, the so-called neutralist prince, and the Petet Lao, or communist prince, brothers all. The cross-class alliance, which it was implemented by the Kennedy brothers in Laos, was then backed up by a program of extermination in which almost 50,000 students and trade union leaders and resistance fighters and organizers of peasant villages were exterminated. That's the real meaning of these cross-class alliances that keep the bourgeoisie in power in the name of peace. And the same so-called back channel for Cuba had the sole intention of enlisting the Cubans in the process of aborting revolutionary upsurge in Latin America. Never believe, for example, that when the Kennedy brothers remove Jimenez in Venezuela and install Betancourt, when Goulart is imposed in Brazil, these so-called social democratic reformers, yes, when the Kaiser aluminum finances the Upper Volta electrification project in Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, you think that these processes of interposing capitalist and bourgeois penetration of these societies is not accompanied by death squads? On the contrary, brother. So the issues here are that the Kennedy brothers are in dispute with Pentagon Capital, if you like, about the modality of imposing imperialist control. And the stakes are high. They are to this very day with the question of taking out Iran, with the destabilization of 60 countries, with the expansion of this war for which 9/11, which is, after all, the treason at the top, is the predicate. But what we have to understand is that we don't have to choose between wings of capital. We have nothing there but our own oppression to gain. Like Barack Obama, who calls for a preemptive strike on Tehran and who is in favor of another such strike in Pakistan, who just sent a message to the United Nations opposing any resolution in support of the Palestinian population in Gaza, this wing of liberalism of which the Kennedys are the emblem has nothing for us. And the assassinations are a method for illuminating how power works, the nature of our ruling class, and the struggles that we have to wage forward. The reason that the Carl Oglesbys and Cal Brightmans, then as now, would rewrite our history and demonize the likes of myself or Bertrand Russell or Jean-Paul Sartre is in the process is because, as I mentioned, the liberal limits do not allow them to engage capitalism as a system and to build a movement of the many of our working people to overthrow it. Because that is our inexorable task, and there will be mass murder and the architecture of the fascist state until we undertake it.
Okay, we'd like to move on to our next question. Sean? Hello, you're on the air. Okay, the number to call is 212-209-2900. We're on the air.
Hello, is that me?
Yes,
that's
is,
you.
Brother. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. And I'm 58, and I lived through a lot of this stuff, and my head was in the sand, and I hardly even know what you're talking about. But I'd like to ask you a question. I read a book, and I don't know if I understand it at all. It was called The Committee of 300. Fourth edition, and it spoke of Bertrand Russell as somebody who was part of this committee of 300 and one of their aims is to exterminate so much of the population, so it will be left to people higher up. Have you ever heard of this?
Yes, I understand what you're describing here. You know, one of our difficulties in addressing this reality, when we talk about, after all, the structure of power in the United States and in other countries is nothing mystical or cult-like or arcane. The U.S. Department of Commerce data shows that 1% of the population in the United States owns and controls more than 95% of the wealth of the rest of us combined. The head of Avis and American Express, former Robert Townsend, in his book Up the Organization, documents that about 5,000 people control what he calls the commanding heights of the U.S. economy. They average about 14 corporate directorships per individual. That's a ruling class. The book you're describing, which is the Committee of 300, is like all this right-wing lunatic stuff about these arcane conspiratorial bloodlines. And Bertrand Russell has been assimilated to this by these, and if you'll forgive me, these Looney Tunes, unquote, because precisely Russell is about something very rational, very scientific, very precise in describing how power works. Let me just talk about the grain of truth that is contained in these references to plans to extirpate populations.
Okay.
The Rockefeller Foundation and a good deal of U.S. Official biological science was designed at what is euphemistically called population control. And the purpose here is because the populations of the oppressed areas of the world, Africa, Asia, and Latin America, are not only growing, but are suffering ever deeper exploitation and immiseration. So the Club of Rome, and you'll find Rockefeller and Kissinger discussing actively how, quote-unquote, to reduce these populations. They ain't talking about condoms, I can tell you that. What they were, what the U.S. policy has entailed is introducing viral agents that are weaponized. The very phenomenon of AIDS itself is, in fact, an operation against the oppressed. For example, in 1987, the London Times, on its front page, published a description of a full-scale investigative report that established that the Centers for Disease Control had imposed a vaccination program on the Congo, having leased about 1 million acres from Mobutu, and they put a grid over the areas in which vaccination was imposed on that populace, and there was a one-to-one correlation between the vaccination zones and the emergence of AIDS. See, so yes, that genocidal intent with respect to the masses of the population of the planet is part and parcel of what imperialism does. We've done an 8-part series on what we call system and terminal decay and the use of viral agents, the SARS and all of that. But that has absolutely nothing to do with some any so-called Illuminati or with shape-shifting reptiles, or let alone poor Bertrand Russell, who was a great philosopher, one of the greatest mathematicians and logicians since Aristotle, who's written over 100 books, who opposed the war in Vietnam and the First World War and was put in 6 months in prison as a consequence, who opposed sexual oppression in his marvelous book, Marriage and Morals, opposing the restrictions and the puritanical attitudes towards sexuality and human emotional liberation. His work, which challenged the organized religion, such as Why I'm Not a Christian, he's a seminal figure. It was a great privilege for me to be working with Bertrand Russell for 10 years. But to demonize this man as a part of some conspiracy, cult conspiracy to enslave peoples, is part of disinformation, undoubtedly sponsored by intelligence agencies. But whether it is or it's not, it's cloud cuckoo land stuff. And the Committee of 300, I'm familiar with the work, is cut from that same cloth.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to speak to you. And I got to find out. Your books are really hard to get. I'm going to see if I can get them on your
To Amazon or go to our website for Hidden History of Zionism or Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, or If you go to our website, brother, you'll see all of our shows for the past 7 years. You can download them for nothing.
Okay, and what about your books? I remember a couple of years ago, I was so defeated. I tried to get your stuff off Amazon. They didn't have any of your stuff.
No, they're available through Amazon.com and also on our website, www.takingaimradio.com.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling.
Listen, thanks for the call, brother. I appreciate it.
Thanks for both of the interesting questions from our listeners. I'm sorry we don't have time to take
more.
Well,
we're going to do more of these call-ins because the callers are very, very thoughtful and intelligent, and I really appreciate their questions and the discussion.
I'd like to announce that WBAI next week is entering into the fund drive. Remember, this is listener-sponsored radio. And the premium, our thank you gift, will be 9/11, permanent war, and the repressive apparatus of the state. Is martial law on the agenda? This was from a lecture given by Ralph and myself and Frank Morales, two-time winner of Sonoma State University's Project Censored Award for Generalism. You may be familiar with Frank Morales and his lectures on police state America and the Pentagon civil disturbance planning, and that's what he discusses in what is going to be our premium. And Ralph and I discussed 9/11 and the architecture of the fascist state. We'll be playing excerpts, and we'll be with you every week. So please tune in next Tuesday at 5 o'clock when we continue to be with you. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman.
And Maya Show, our program Truth as Casualty today will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. And also, please contact us via email at takingaim@pacbell, that's PACBELL.net. We'll be with you next week.
Comrades, get ready for the decision by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals on the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. It can come in any day now. Any judgment that means either Mumia's execution or his